When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! Welcome to the dinosaur edition of Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of a very depressing week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined by Anna Szymanski and Jordan Weissman. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
And this week was the week that the United States officially pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which makes it one of those weeks a bit like the one after Brexit or the one after the election in the US, where I'm just feeling horribly depressed. We are going to talk about that, obviously. We are also going to talk about credit in America. Did you know that your credit score is going up? It is. Well, I mean, statistically speaking, it is anyway.
Maybe. Yes. Possibly.
It turns out that Americans have never been so creditworthy as they are now, or at least not in a very long time. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. And we are going to talk, because Anna is here, and also just because it's an amazing story, about the tangled tale of Goldman Sachs bailing out the Venezuelan government by buying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of distressed paper. This is an awesome story. You're going to want to hang around for that. But I think we can't but start with Paris.
Yes.
Which is, you know, all right-thinking people know that this is a really dreadful thing that the president just did.
No, I'm not so right-thinking.
So Jordan isn't so right-thinking. So the decision was made in the wake of President Trump's first trip abroad. He jets around the world. He comes back saying, I've jetted around the world and I'm going to make a decision on Paris. These things are somehow connected, I guess, in his mind.
Overuse of carbon.
And then once he comes back, but before the official decision is made, there's a Wall Street Journal op-ed by the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, and by Gary Cohn, who used to be the COO of Goldman Sachs and is now the, you know, chief economic advisor to the president. And they write this thing where they say, quote, the world is not a global community, but an arena where nations, NGOs, and businesses engage and compete for advantage rather than deny this elemental nature of international affairs. We embrace it. And this is more or less the most sort of red-blooded explication of Trumpism that I've certainly ever seen from the likes of Gary Cohn, where they're like, this is what America first is. There is no such thing as society as that Thatcher would have, at least international society. It's one country against the next. And so we've decided that the Paris Agreement is bad for America. And even if it's good for everyone else, if it's bad for America, we're going to pull out.
Well, what's kind of funny about that is I'm pretty sure, I don't know where McMaster stood, but I'm pretty sure Gary Cohn was actually arguing to stay in Paris. And as was lots of corporate America,
almost all of corporate America,
including coal companies. It was almost
including
impossible.
Exxon,
which is actually, and that's why I'm sort of, and this is not my original point, I should say, but there's this I'm sort of glad this has happened. And in a weird way, the counterintuitive take has almost become the conventional wisdom among a lot of climate activists here, which is that Trump had two choices, right? He was either going to stay in this climate agreement and basically flout all of its rules, because no matter what, he was going to do away with Obama's Green Power Plan, and he was going to try to unleash the fossil fuels industries in any way he could in the United States. So he was going to flout the rules and try to negotiate sort of a less stringent commitment, you know, make the agreement less powerful, less effective. Or he could just leave entirely and allow the rest of the countries that signed on to this thing to kind of continue along as they were. And so...
I'm not quite following you here. Yeah. If you're saying that if he had missed the U.S. targets, or if he altered the U.S. targets, how would that prevent the rest of the countries from continuing on as they were?
So basically, there were two... Well, he could have done two things. One is he could have just stayed in the agreement and then just completely flouted the U.S. Yes, that was an option. And that just says, okay, we're in this and we're not taking it seriously. And that sends this signal to other countries that you can kind of behave the same way. The other possibility is that he could actually try to renegotiate it. And he sort of signaled maybe they will. But that was something that was on the table. People were discussing that idea that he would stay in but say, hey, we want this to be changed. We want to weaken it. And that was actually pretty much what the fossil fuel industry seemed to want. That's why Exxon and all the coal companies.
The reason they want is because at the end of the day, if you're an executive and you're considering what you're going to be doing for the next 10 years in terms of multi-billion dollar CapEx programs, you have to have a predictable framework of where regulations are going to be. And this creates tremendous uncertainty.
Well, I think they know what Trump's doing on regulations. I mean, as far as the U.S. goes, I mean, he's going to undo the Green Power Plan. That was the biggest thing. That was the biggest climate initiative that the Obama administration has. and Trump is going to try to reverse that. So they have to work from that.
For right now. But yeah. I think the idea that I would imagine most people in corporate America have is at a certain point when he gets out and a more reasonable person comes in, then things are going to change again. And there's just tremendous uncertainty about where America is going to be in terms of regulations moving forward.
And also, like, I want to push back a little bit on this idea of renegotiating, because there are two different things going on here. One is the framework, which is basically every country in the world has agreed that it will set its own targets, and then every 5 years it will report on whether it met those targets.
Yeah.
Then there is the targets themselves, which are entirely set by the individual countries. So if you want to change that target, there's no negotiation involved. There's just changing the target. So when you're talking about renegotiation, who are you negotiating with and what are you trying to negotiate? What are you trying to change?
I am not saying that the Trump administration... I'm saying this is what was reported as an idea that was on the table.
Okay, but be clear about what was being reported. What was the idea?
The idea was that Trump was going to go in and say, we need to change these targets. Possibly he may have said we should... if we're going to change ours down, other countries can also...
And I guess there is an argument that if he had stayed in the agreement, but he had completely degraded what it meant for America to be in the agreement, that potentially kind of worldwide, that could have had a more negative impact about what people thought about Paris. Whereas I guess the argument would be if we're entirely out and the rest of the world can actually meet their targets, then maybe... Yeah. Overall, the agreement will appear to have more legitimacy.
Yeah.
So I like 10% buy that. It's this weird idea that if Donald Trump violates a voluntary target which was set by his predecessor and which he has denounced, then that's like a very bad thing. And so he needs to leave the entire framework just to avoid that. I mean, okay, fine. I do think that civic society generally in the U.S., if you look at the mayors and the governors and the CEOs, have stepped up quite impressively to say, look, the president does what the president does, but we are sticking to as close as we can to this framework. And I think the California in particular is incredibly important here, because if California does things like have, you know, emission standards for automobiles, anyone who wants to sell their car in the U.S. effectively needs to adopt those California standards.
And also, if the rest of the world starts to adopt these standards, then U.S. products that are going to be sold in those other markets are going to have to meet certain standards. So it's not as though the U.S. actually can completely divorce itself.
Trump's climate policies are still a blow, and they would be a blow to our future, regardless of whether or not he left Paris. That's the thing to remember here. In the end, like, this is sort of the last symbolic capstone to his overall policy of pumping as much carbon in the air as possible in order to bring back 4 or 5 coal jobs in West Virginia. But, you know, yes, there is a, to some extent, it will slightly be mitigated, at least, by what California will do. I don't think we should overemphasize that. I mean, if you look at the projections, like, California is a sliver, is still only a sliver of what the overall decline in carbon use that was supposed to happen.
No one is saying that California is most carbon emissions. What we're saying is that California's regulations affect more than just California. And in general, the engine of the global economy is cities. More than half of the world is urban now, and most of the economic activity in the world is in cities. Most of the carbon emissions in the world basically are generated in one way or another by or for cities. And one of the things that has gone along with that is that global mayors have done a much better job of getting together and becoming a global force over the past, I would say, 10 years or so than they ever were. And they can act collectively in a way that actually has as much impact as any individual country has.
Certainly, also because a lot of the emissions are concentrated in cities. So if cities can work to reduce that, that has a larger impact.
And the global mayors are all in favor of Paris, including the American mayors. But the big picture of this decision is a bad decision and it's going to be harmful, I think, is still true. And it's true not because necessarily it means that U.S. emissions are going to be higher, because, as you said, like, the federal regulations were going to be lifted anyway. But it's true because the whole concept of a global community has basically been thrown out the window by H.R. McMaster, Gary Cohn, Donald Trump, and the rest of the administration.
I think that's true. I think that staying in the agreement and flouting it would have had a similar effect, and in a way maybe more subtly corrosive. Whereas, like, this, by actually exiting, in a way has galvanized a lot of other countries. You're now seeing, like you said, global mayors, you're seeing China, you're seeing Europe all come together and say, no, we are going to support this. So in a way, I think by pulling out Trump, I mean, there might be a silver lining here, I'm saying. Instead of just kind of degrading it from within, he's made everyone else bind together a little bit stronger.
If you embolden the EU and China and the rest of the global world to essentially push back on everything Trump's doing, you know, maybe that could. And I also think it's important to remember that part of the reason that U.S. emissions have come down is simply because of math, is simply because it is no longer efficient to pump coal. And that's not going to change. If anything, that is just going to become more and more. So I think it's important to remember that corporate America is going to stay in even if the U.S. is pulled
out. Although the one thing which, the one piece of economic damage which is going to happen here is that the investment in clean energy and renewable energy, which was a large part of the Obama plan to reduce emissions, has now basically been jettisoned. The United States government is not going to put that much money and effort into those technologies anymore, and that's going to be bad for a huge swathe of industry.
Yes, but I think that because these technologies are increasingly becoming more cost efficient, I think investment dollars are still going to go there. Because if investors are, I mean, yes, I do agree with you that I think this is going to be a blow in terms of federal dollars. But I think in terms of private money, if people see that this is where the future is and this is more efficient, money's still going
to
go there.
And I can't believe I'm taking this role, because usually I'm the one saying the U.S. is the whole world and you guys are telling me to be less provincial. But again, when you have China and Europe trying to move in this direction, there are going to be very large markets for these technologies. And going again to the idea that China now has stepped up and said, no, we still support Paris. In a way, this may, I mean, you know, another silver lining here is that they now see this as an opportunity to really assert themselves as global leaders. And so they may take it even more seriously than they did before, just to show up the U.S., just to say, hey, we are at the front of the pack. We are at, you know, we're going to lead this charge.
And this reminds me of President Xi's speech in Davos in January, where he came out, you know, in, like, Chinese presidents rarely, you know, make those kind of international appearances. And he was basically going up to the international community and saying, I'm willing to take on a certain amount of this world leadership mantle along with, like, Angela Merkel. And in so far as the United States is very explicitly saying they have no interest in it.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, silver linings, just outline again. instead of sticking around and undermining this agreement from within, Trump has pulled out. And as a reaction to that, you now have Europe and China and global mayors clinging to this agreement even more strongly than they would before. And maybe this will encourage them to be more aggressive in going after their targets to some degree. I think that's the summary.
And the other silver lining is that it was a weak withdrawal rather than a strong one, in that he's withdrawing only from the Paris Agreement and not from the underlying UN treaty. So the treaty remains, and any future administration can very, very easily just snap back in again.
And the last silver lining I will say is that, you know, when Trump was first coming into office, it seems as though he could send a tweet and then corporate America would really act and get very frightened. Whereas now, I think what we've seen is they're saying no. They're pushing back. And I think moving forward, that could potentially also be a good thing.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Jordan.
Yeah.
Have you checked your credit score recently?
Not since I made the potentially disastrous decision of buying a home. But no, I haven't. But I assume it's fine. And on average, if I am the average American, my credit score is certainly getting better.
You are not the average American.
That's true. I'm not. But...
But yeah, you managed to buy a home with a good interest rate because your credit score was perfectly fine when you bought the home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. And
this is not uncommon. And this is despite the fact that you're burdened with student loans.
Yes, despite the fact. Well, student loans, the interaction of student loans and credit scores is a complicated subject we could spend many an hour on. However, there's some good news for just about America's credit worthiness. Our credit scores have reached a record high. So we've fully recovered from the crisis, and now they're better than ever. We are more credit worthy than ever, apparently.
Those of us who have credit scores.
Those of us who have credit scores, exactly.
Which is also more people than ever, right?
Probably,
yes.
Yes. And so the Wall Street Journal had an article about this. The share of consumers deemed to be the riskiest with a score below 600 hit a new low of roughly 40 million people, or 20% of adults. Meanwhile, the average credit score nationwide hit 700 in April.
This is a nice round number.
Yes.
A very, very easy, nice round number.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that your average Slate Money listener has a credit score even above 700.
Yes, we are all Lake Wobegon. We're all above average. This is almost like a mechanical thing, right? You would expect credit scores to have healed a bunch since the recession, because it takes 7 years for bankruptcies and for mortgage defaults and such to clear off credit scores. And in that time, while you have that on you're probably not taking out a lot of debt.
Right. This is what happens in credit cycles.
Yes. And so eventually you have these wounds, and then you convalesce, and then you come out in some ways looking better than ever. You have this fresh, clean credit report.
So a week or two ago, you were talking about cars.
Yes.
And the problem with the auto industry. And you were saying something about subprime loans and loan defaults.
So that is an exception here. So actually, and now if you look at what's happening with car loan, car loan originations are decreasing, and they are, the default rates or delinquency rates are kind of staying stubbornly high / rising. So that is consistent with the idea that car sales may be falling in part because of credit issues. And again, we do have that 20% of adults with low credit scores who are in that subprime category. So it's not as if all is well, but at least for people who are in the sort of, overall, America is looking healthier, even if there are kind of warts, here and there.
So I guess the implication is that we are becoming a country where only poor people buy cars.
Well, poor people do need to have cars.
Yeah. And rich people don't need to have cars. And I think that's an interesting, like, grand macro thing. But again, let's try and keep our eyes on the prize.
So there's a second story also that's happening, though. And this is the one I know that interests Anna. So on one hand, our credit scores are better than ever, which is really good for us macroeconomically, theoretically, because more people can get credit, they can buy things. Also, this week, the New York Fed reported that total household debt hit a new high. It finally passed the level it was in 2008. So in nominal terms, not in real terms. So if you don't adjust for inflation, just the total amount of debt. But something kind of intriguing has happened there, where before, you know, that was, you know, well, it still is mostly housing debt.
Right.
But a higher percentage, it's less housing debt now and more student debt. There's been sort of a switch where before student debt made up about 5% of the total amount of, I guess, household debt out there. Now it's up to 10%. And so you're starting to see this swap of the kinds of debt that Americans are carrying.
And if you listen to people like Adair Turner talking about the difference between like socially useful and socially useless debt, mm-hmm. he will say, you know, that mortgages are the classic socially useless debt. Like, borrowing money to buy a house is, it does nothing for society, whereas borrowing money to get an education is much more socially useful. And so this is a objectively better mix
right,
than it was
I think
before.
Some people will look at this number and they'll go, oh, is this concerning that we're seeing debt at these high levels? And I would argue, I don't really think it is, because taking on more debt to educate yourself is going to have, we think, longer positive dividends than taking out lots of money for housing loans. And also on top of that, because ultimately the mortgage market is still so much larger and so much more integrated into the global financial market, problems in the mortgage market are going to have many more ramifications than problems in the student loan debt.
Also, student loans have gone for decades with incredibly high delinquency rates. If you have a car loan and a mortgage and a credit card and a student loan and you can't repay all of them, most of the time, the first one you default on is the student loan, because there's really the lowest negative ramifications
they
for doing
can't
that.
Take your degree away. So
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that so I buy the theory somewhat that student loan debt is socially useful debt. And especially one thing to keep in mind is about a third of all new student loans are actually graduate degrees. You can argue how useful graduate degrees are.
Depending on what it's
yeah. you can argue. But I mean, like, to some, you know, these are people who are borrowing graduate degrees tend to be in a better position, and they really are investing. That it is a investment with a good return. However, there's also obviously problematic student debt. There is socially useless student debt.
Yes.
And that does make up, you know, you have to remember, again, that we have these stubborn 11% delinquency rates right now for student loans, which are kind of a symbol of the fact that you have a lot of kind of low-level borrowers who probably shouldn't have, you know, taking out that loan to go to a for-profit school in the first place.
Especially if they never graduated
right,
with a degree.
And, yes.
And I feel there that the problem is not really the debt. You know, if you wind up going to college and then leaving with no degree, that's bad on a number of different levels. The fact that you've wound up with debt, which you're going to wind up defaulting on, is certainly bad. But the real cost to you is the opportunity cost. The opportunity cost in terms of the foregone income and like career development you could have had absent going to college is significantly larger than the amount of your student loan.
Also, if you're going to a for-profit college as opposed to a community college or a city or state university. Because again, a lot of this debt is in for-profit colleges where even if you get the degree, many of them are essentially useless.
So, I mean, I guess there are two ways of looking at this, because I want to kind of tie together these two stories about credit scores and overall household debt. One is a really happy story here, right? Credit scores are better than ever. Americans are overall in a pretty good place in terms of, I guess, their FICO scores, whatever. And then at the same time, we're moving from socially useless debt, quote unquote, with mortgage debt, especially subprime mortgage debt, to socially useful debt, student loans. So like, yay, hurrah. The not so great story, I guess you could tell here, is that Americans are having a harder time. There are a lot of Americans who are still borrowing for degrees that are not really worth anything or kind of bad investments, and are also having a harder time, you know, putting down money for the traditional savings vehicle that was a home, that was a taking out a mortgage and investing in real estate, which was essentially their big savings account. And so I guess, you know, do you think that I kind of worry about that second story here. Is that, do either of you feel like that's a...
I'm still curious. I know there is often these claims, and I haven't honestly looked at it closely enough to, but yeah. Whether the higher student loan debts that people are holding are actually holding people back from buying homes.
I spent a lot of time looking at that a few years ago, and the conclusion I came to is it's not the amount of student debt that really stops people, it's the defaults. Again, it's people who have defaulted on their debt, and then there's the larger question of, are those people just in a financially terrible place anyway, and the default on that is sort of symptomatic of a bigger problem, or is it actually having a student loan debt that went bad that's keeping them from applying and getting a mortgage? I think it's probably a little bit of both.
I need to jump in here and do my, you know, obligatory, it's not bad if you don't buy a home thing.
Yeah. Right.
And if we're moving from a world where if we're moving into a world of declining home ownership, which we are, and part of the decline in mortgages is simply a function of the fact that fewer people own homes now. And that's good. It means you have a much more flexible labor force and you have much, you know, I mean, yes, you lose that enforced savings vehicle, but I do believe that home ownership in the US is probably too high and should probably come down.
And that money could probably be invested more efficiently.
I guess what I'm saying here is I'm wondering if the rise of bad student loan debt, because that is part of the story, and the fall of home ownership mortgages. I mean, they're related to some extent. Both of them are a sign of people having a harder time, you know, getting by or getting ahead in life without a great deal of education. Some of those people just aren't, you know, a position really to get a higher degree. And so it kind of all goes, as they try to strive for the American dream or whatever you want to call for it, it all goes wrong for them. And I guess that's the dark side of this story.
And the other side is that maybe finally, I don't know, what are we, sort of 10 years after the crisis now, maybe finally we're beginning to see what a world could look like, which isn't, where growth isn't driven by debt and by lending and by credit. In the run-up to the crisis, I remember this vividly in sort of 2005, 2006, there was this feeling that the world was running to stand still and it needed to borrow more and more money every year just to get the same increment of growth. And maybe now we can get, you know, we're finding some kind of a growth model, and it might not be as high growth as we would want, but which doesn't involve just borrowing enormous amounts of money and lending enormous amounts of money to people who can't afford to pay it back.
I mean, I would say that it's still a lot of consumer spending is fueled by debt, and that essentially is still fueling the
American economy. Well, that's credit cards, and credit card debt is going up, but I believe, Jordan, it's not reached its pre-crisis levels.
You're right. No, it has not reached its pre-crisis levels. It's still a little bit below. I think you're right to some extent, Felix. I hate to use this word, but we are sort of moving a little bit more to a human capital model, and we're at least getting, you know, where instead of residential fixed investment driving the U.S. economy completely, we've inched a tiny bit away from that, and maybe that's good. Having less of it, less of our future prospects hinged to the housing market.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
All right. Anna Szymanski, every week the Slate Money team has this email which goes around saying, what are we going to talk about this week? And every week we're like, let's talk about Venezuela. And every week Felix is the killjoy saying, what's the news hook? And now we have just the juiciest news story
yes.
of all time,
yes.
where the great global vampire squid Goldman Sachs Somehow managed to inject, what, $800 million into the Venezuelan central bank?
Yeah, I mean, the face value of the bonds was like $2.8 billion, and they bought them for about 31 cents.
And so, okay, so let's rewind here. This comes out, it's a big scandal, but the headline is that Goldman Sachs bought a bunch of bonds.
Yeah, the reason that this, I think, has gotten a lot more coverage, these bonds are... I mean, not these specific bonds, but Venezuela and PDVSA bonds. PDVSA is the state-owned oil company of Venezuela, are regularly traded. The reason that this particular purchase created a lot of controversy was because it appears that these bonds were held by the central bank.
So as a result, that was just an infusion of money straight to a dictatorship.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this is the huge difference between like primary markets and secondary markets. If I buy a painting from an artist, the money goes to the artist. If I buy a painting, you know, at auction, it goes to the person who owned the painting. And if you, if in this case, if I buy a $2.8 billion bond deal from Venezuela directly, that money, however much money I'm paying for it, goes to Venezuela directly and goes to prop up this loathed Maduro regime.
Yeah, and essentially to pay their near-term bond maturities. Because what they're essentially, they do not have enough hard currency to both pay their importers and pay their debt, or their debt interest payments.
So the question, the first question I have for you is, like, are bonds fungible? Is there actually a sort of moral distinction between buying a bond on the open market from someone who owns it versus buying a bond, whether it's brokered or not, from the Venezuelan central bank?
And I mean, I think I should probably say here that, like, again, I used to work in EM distressed debt. I have many friends who work in EM distressed debt. So
there are good people there.
Yes, I just want that to be very clear. But I do think you get into a lot of these ethical issues in the EM market. And this, these particular bonds, this is a very tough issue because, I mean, I know the Ricardo Hausman argument, he is a professor at Harvard, has basically said that both are bad, that whether you're trading on the secondary market and essentially benefiting off of this situation, or whether you're essentially buying the bonds almost directly from the government and funding them, at the end of the day, you're not engaging in good activity either way. And I don't think there's really any way I don't think there's really any argument against that. I think it would be very hard. I think, unfortunately, in this community, it is very hard to justify this.
So just to stick to the question, Goldman Sachs and many other asset managers own a lot of Venezuelan debt. And in large part, they have to because Venezuela is part of the bond indexes. And if you don't own any Venezuelan debt, then you really risk underperforming. So given that, if we accept that this Venezuelan debt is out there and just by law of conservation of mass, it has to be owned by someone. If I am a bond investor and I have some morals, is it worse for me to buy bonds from the Venezuelan central bank, thereby propping up the regime for however long they can use that money for, than it is for me to buy bonds from some relatively innocent bond investor?
Honestly, I don't think there's a huge difference either way. And I think the other argument that, well, we should drop the bonds from the index so then people essentially don't have to hold them or people don't have to benchmark against that, then also raises the question like, well, okay, but then you'd just be selling those bonds to other people. So is that ultimately...
Because they don't go away.
Well, right.
Well, so I guess... My question is it feasible to have a market-wide boycott of these kinds of bonds?
What would that mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, so Felix says these have to be owned by someone, and it's true. Like, you're not going to make the bonds disappear, at least until they all hit maturity. But theoretically, a lot of people could just say, I'm not going to buy these bonds. And so there's just no market for them. Their value drops. You know, there's no point in issuing new ones because no one's going to buy them. Is that even remotely realistic is
that's,
my question.
There have been many, many periods where many countries have had bonds outstanding but have had no access to the market. The window is closed. And
but for moral
that's
reasons,
common.
So that usually is because it's become a basket case. I'm asking, and in is there like a moral boycott situation you can imagine that unfolding in?
And essentially, the, you know, this is an issue where part of the reason that right now these bonds are yielding so much that
someone's going to buy them.
Yes.
That in the end, there'll be someone to break the boycott.
Yes. Well, that's just a different way of saying the same thing, that like whatever the price is the price that someone is willing to pay. And then you can work out the yield from the price. The more interesting question I have here, though, because we need to talk about this, is dinosaur?
It's this tiny British brokerage that where they bought the bonds through, which is part of the reason everybody says, like, even though Goldman says we didn't buy them directly from the government.
So is that Goldman's argument? They're like, it's okay, we didn't buy the bonds directly from the government. We bought them from
a dinosaur. Yeah, and it does. I mean, I think nobody takes that seriously.
So Goldman did know that it was being sold by the government.
I would imagine.
Because this is, by the way, $2.8 billion of a $3 billion bond deal. Like, they bought the overwhelming majority of one deal, and you can't do that just by some secondary market deal.
Right.
But, like, tell me, because this is a company I've never heard of before. Presumably you have heard
PDVSA?
Of it before. Dinosaur.
Oh, dinosaur.
So a question. Have you ever heard of these people?
No, I had actually not.
And you have been intimately involved in this world for many years, and you have never heard of dinosaurs.
No.
So they really are tiny.
They're tiny, yeah.
Is it possible that they are entirely set up solely for the purpose of laundering Venezuelan bonds? No. Okay, that they at
but
least
when,
do something.
But yes. When you were working on this desk, would you get calls from like random brokerages in places like London saying, you know, psst, want to buy a big bond deal? Or like,
no. So that is not how it works. I mean,
but that's clearly how it works in this case, right?
In this case, again, I'm not a Goldman. I don't know specifically how they functioned, but in most firms, you know, you have certain brokers that you work with. And when you're talking about distressed EM paper, there aren't that many brokers who are trading in it.
So this is a really weird deal just on the basis that Goldman bought a $2.8 billion deal from a brokerage that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah, it's like a guy showed up in an alley with a trench coat, opened his jacket, and there were some Venezuelan bonds in it.
That alone makes the deal weird and unusual.
Yeah, it is. There are many things about this that are just questionable and just raise the decision to do this now, I think, is just raising a lot of questions. Because again, I still think there is ultimately a difference between actually buying on the secondary market and directly funding.
Okay, well, you do think there's a difference.
I guess, yeah, I'm going back and forth because
you're vacillating.
I am vacillating.
So
like, my point is like, I'm not going to try to justify either one.
Yeah.
Because I think you can bring up moral issues either way.
But
I do still think that if Goldman had simply bought these bonds, or if this had been some type of other different issuance and they had just bought it from some other well-known firm, I don't think it would be getting the same press that it's getting now. I think it's getting this press because it is specifically seen as Goldman funding the Venezuelan government.
And also it's getting the press because Goldman is Goldman.
I mean, that's
if it was BlackRock, I don't think people would have blinked so much.
No, I mean, and if you actually look at the in terms of PDVSA holdings, you're looking at like Fidelity and PIMCO, who have some of the kind of highest holdings of these bonds.
Right. And I can easily imagine that PIMCO could have done this deal quite quietly and no one would have noticed and no one would have said anything. But there is this peculiar specialness to Goldman, which works sometimes in its favor and sometimes against it.
People love to hate Goldman Sachs. And Goldman isn't wrong when they say that, again, it's not like they're the only people who are involved in these bonds. It's not as though that, you know, again, it is true that if you hold a number of EM ETFs or index funds, you likely have exposure.
Yeah.
They're not wrong about that. But that's not really a justification. I mean, I think this is the problem, is that when you try to justify this, you essentially just dig your hole deeper. Because if you're trying to say like, well, we're giving them, you know, yes, we are paying, but then maybe they'll use that money to actually pay the importers. We know that that's not the case.
So final question on this one. Goldman ended up paying 31 cents on the dollar for these bonds, which mature in, what, 5 years?
2022s.
And in 5 years, according to the bond contract, they have to get paid. Goldman has to get paid 100 cents on the dollar. And in the meantime, they're getting a bunch of coupon payments, assuming there's no default.
Right.
So the question I have for you is, what is the chance that Goldman is going to get repaid in full on
this? Oh, well, I can tell, though. So this I can very much tell you. So there is a strong, again, this is going to sound very crass in light of what's actually happening in Venezuela.
Oh,
so
boy.
Very fair. But this is actually this trade makes a lot of sense. I think it's not as risky as I think when people look at it, because the reality is you're paying 31 cents. So I don't think you're paying 31 cents with the expectation you're going to get paid out at par. You're paying 31 cents with the expectation that Venezuela is going to make it through 2017 and 2018 because they have a $8 billion hole to fill this year, $7 billion next year. So, and people think they can fill that.
So basically, you're paying 31 cents hoping you get 50 cents back.
Because this is the thing. If you look at what we expect recovery value to be in the event of a default, you're almost certainly going to be right now getting essentially more than that. And then on top of that, if you factor in coupon payments, so you have tremendous downside protection. And then on the off chance that a new government gets in, they're able to actually start ramping up production at PDVSA, and then you actually do get paid out closer to par, then that's a tremendous return on the bonds. So that is why they're going to do the trade. I'm not saying that makes it good. I'm just saying that is why you would do that trade.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at Progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let's have some numbers. I am going to start with a fun number, which is 849,751%. And that is the return on a hypothetical trading algorithm that a Bloomberg reporter called Danny Berger managed to come up with, where she went back for 5 or 6 years and bought any stock with the letters CAT in the stock price.
Any.
This is the cat trade.
It's a very specific factor model.
She's like, I like cats, so I'm going to buy stocks with the letters cat in them. And she managed to fiddle around with Bloomberg and built this factor model, which returned 849,751% over 6 years. Now, this was in large part due to the, quote, basically untradable Catskill Litigation Trust, which gained 79,000% this year and is still trading at, like, one penny. So it's not obvious that this would work. But she did phone up Cliff Asness, who's the, emperor of factor model trading, who's like, that's completely ridiculous. No one should use cats as a factor. They have no basis. I only use parakeets.
Good line.
So, yeah. So, if you want to go and make money in the future, like, cats works in the future, but
it's going to be arbitrated away.
I would highly recommend
I would highly recommend
going, like, pivoting to the parakeet model going
yes,
forwards.
Yes.
Cliff Asness has your back.
Yeah, this has been published.
Screw momentum.
The information
Let's go,
is
parakeet.
Totally useless. It's now public. Yes. Anyway, the market's
efficient market. It's already been priced in.
Priced in. Cats are priced in.
Done.
Okay.
Anna, what's your number?
So my number is 1,000. So Amazon's stock price breached 1,000 this week.
That's dollars.
Yes.
$1,000 for one share of stock.
And the reason I think this is interesting is that I think it represents a lot of what's actually happening in the market right now, because it's not just that it shows that, you know, the power of the tech industry and Amazon. But normally it used to be that when stocks became very expensive, you'd do a stock split. Because you wanted to...
Oh, is this about average stock price?
Well, yeah, well, yes. The average stock price has...
It's almost $100 now.
Yes. And it's because, again, it used to be that you didn't want your stock to appear expensive and you wanted to appeal to mom and pop investors and people picking individual stocks.
Now no one gives a shit.
Exactly. Because on the individual retail side, people are more indexing. And then on the institutional side, people are really concerned about fees. And when you have additional shares, you have to pay more fees. So I think this price kind of represents all of these changes that are happening right now in the market.
And cool. I will also add, just as a PS here, like, we've always grown up with ExxonMobil being the most valuable company by market cap in America. Right now, the top five most valuable companies by market cap in America are Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, and Microsoft. Like, five big tech companies are all worth more than ExxonMobil.
My turn?
Your turn.
Yep. Okay. My number is 8.7%, which is Germany's current account surplus as a percentage of its GDP. We're going to get into that. This past week, you may have seen that Donald Trump is having some tensions with Germany, not just over Paris, but also...
he called them very, very bad.
Very, very bad.
That second very, right?
Yeah. Also, if you're depending on the translation, it might be very, very evil, but assuming it's Trump, I'm going to go with bad here. So, and a large part, that's about trade. He's not happy about the fact that Germany has a trade surplus of the U.S. And Donald Trump is wrong about many, many, most, almost all things. But one of the very few subjects I feel like he's actually sort of zeroed in on something correctly is when it comes to Germany and trade.
Do you think that Germany is very, very bad?
I think Germany may be the most problematic actor in global trade.
I know. My cufflinks here.
I wrote an article saying that they may have done a better job gaming the global trade system than any other nation at this point. And here, like, to get a sense of this, so a current account surplus is basically, it's the widest measure of your trade and financial flows. But think of it as, just for simplicity's sake right here, your trade surplus. That is 8.7% of their economy. That is the largest in the world. China's, by comparison, is 1.8% of its economy. Germany's is not only larger as a percentage of its economy, it's actually larger in absolute terms as well. It's actually, so overall, Germany just dwarfs the rest of the world when it comes to trade. And those kinds of imbalances, as we've talked about on the show before, are very problematic, especially if you're also in the European Union. You can argue that Germany is essentially sucking the life force out of the rest of Europe.
Although I agree with you, I do think it's important to remember that Germany doesn't actually control their own currency. But
that's part of how they're gaming this, between that and their labor market.
Right, but I agree with you, but part of the reason that their products are so competitive is because essentially the euro is not valued where it should be. And they don't actually have control over that. And I think one thing to remember, they actually have been the critics of ECB policy of keeping rates very low, which is part of the reason you have a very weak euro. So I don't disagree with you, but I think they're taking advantage of what's going on right now, although I don't think they're necessarily controlling it as much.
Like, the question is, what choice do they have? Should they just become less productive?
No, they could deficit spend. I mean, this is what...
Yes, and they do have fiscal space. And I think this is an area where almost anyone would argue that they have fiscal space to stimulate consumer spending more because, this, you know, essentially the German population does not spend. Yeah. And then their banks do very, very bad things with their savings.
Yeah. The thing to know there is that spending, like if you have a surplus, if your consumers aren't spending and you have a surplus and that you have excess savings and your government is surplus, that's going to lead to a trade surplus.
Right.
If you spend and if your government deficit spends and your, you know, population saves less, you're going to import more. So they do have some control here of this giant trade balance, and they are just being obstinate. They're being way too frugal. It's the paradox of thrift.
As the German at the table, I am going to say that, you know, number one, Germany is one of the global leaders in solar power. They're definitely fully behind the Paris Agreement. And maybe what they're doing is they're showing the way to prosperity without massive consumer spending. I'm German. My family in Germany doesn't spend huge amounts of money, and that's okay.
Everyone can't have a trade surplus.
Right. I'm not saying they can.
Okay.
I don't know why you're thinking I'm saying that.
Then they're not importing goods from other...
What I'm saying is that Germans don't spend a lot of money on themselves. And that's what you're upset about. You're saying they should be spending more money on themselves. And I'm saying, well, maybe if we're thinking about the planet here, spending less money on ourselves is a good thing.
This is the numbers round, so I won't
leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that. Okay, yeah. That, I think, is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Email us. Our email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Dan Schrader, June Thomas, Steve Lichtai, Andy Bowers, and the whole Panoply crew. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.